Welcome to Gay Mystery Podcast, featuring interviews with renowned LGBTQ authors and up-and-coming talent of mystery, suspense, and thriller novels. I'm your host, Brad Shreve, and Justine Adamick is here with her weekly recommendation. Justine, do you know what's so special about this week?
I don't know a lot of things that are special about this week. You know, the fires are covering my part of the world.
Well, we're not too smoky over here in this part of the world, but the exciting news is this is our 50th episode.
Wow. That kind of snuck up on me. Well, that gives us a bright spot today.
Yes, it does. And our studio audience is going wild.
We've got a live studio audience joined
by my daughter Amanda and our dog Maria. You haven't seen them all this time? They've been sitting there.
Well, you know, I try not to look behind me. you're facing them.
There you go. So what's going on this week? What you got for us?
I have got another classic book. I'm trying to divvy up between classic books and new releases and contemporary bestsellers or award winners. So this week I'm back in the classics. I read something on Facebook where somebody said, you know, I really don't pick up the older books because, you know, there's so much and a lot of it wasn't good. And so I decided that really I need to, like, point out some of the classics that the newcomer to the gay literature world really needs to add. This one is Dorian Gray, and it's spelled D-O-R-I-E-N Gray. That's the author. It's a pseudonym for Roger Margeson. He died in 2015, unfortunately. And it's the Dick Hardesty mystery series, and I'm reviewing book one, The Butcher's Son. Now, for some reason, looking back, book two was published before book one. And I can't find anything why. I asked our resident bibliographer, Matt Lubbers Moore, and he couldn't find out when he was putting together the bibliography. So if any of our readers were around back then and actually remember what happened, it would be great if they could drop us a line.
There could be an interesting story there.
Yeah. So that's where we begin. This really is a classic, and it came out in 2000, but it is set right after Stonewall. The protagonist, Dick Hardesty, starts out as a PR guy, and by the end of the book, he becomes a PI guy, PR public relations to PI private investigator. So in this one, he's a public relations guy who gets swept into a mystery and ends up, you know, tracking down the solution and decides that really is something that he wants to pursue. And he's already got a few clients set up by the end of the book. So he is on a PR campaign. His crazy boss, you know, takes all the credit and gives him all the drudge work and orders him around that he should get something done, even though he's done it before. He's generally, you know, not happy, about to quit, when his boss calls him in and says they're doing the entire campaign for the LA police chief who is running for governor. And the LA police chief is very anti-gay, and he is very conservative, very much law and order in a way that, you know, echoes the law and order wing of this world today. So he doesn't want to take it, and his boss says, I'll give you 15% pay hike for this campaign, and he asks for 25%, and he gets 25%. So they put it in writing, and now he's committed. He's committed to the whole campaign, and he's got this idea in the back of his head that he might want to throw a wrench into the works that nobody can spot, but which knocks the police chief out of the race, and nobody will ever know it's him. The police chief has 5 children, and the oldest is a reverend. As you can imagine, in books such as these, there's a ping of the Dick Hardesty gaydar when he meets Kevin, the minister.
Ah.
So Kevin is in charge of the portion of the campaign that Dick Hardesty is involved with. And so they end up spending a lot of time together. Meanwhile, out in the wider world of Los Angeles, an arsonist has been firebombing gay nightclubs. And when the book starts, there's a 6-club firebombed. The bombs go off after dark, when people have just closed up. And they all bear the same signature of a known arsonist. That known arsonist has been in jail for the last 2 years. So one has to wonder, is there an apprentice or is it someone on the inside? And of course, the police chief stands up at the front of the press conference and says, well, it could be a hate group, or it could just be a jealous boyfriend. That is the sum total of his disdain for this investigation, and he tries to ignore it as much as possible.
This story sounds like a tangled web in a good way.
It is a tangled web in a good day, but it also explores themes of the police and the gay community being at odds, which happened often in the years after Stonewall and continuing, less so into the present. But it's diminished since then, but it's pretty much continued throughout. And that is the underlying tension in many of the books written in that day and age.
And what are you going to rate it for us?
I think it's an intriguing mystery. One of the things, last week on your show, Chris Rice was on, and you said that the one thing you really liked about his books was, he could give you a setting in just, 3 or 4 sentences, and you got it. And he could describe a character in 3 or 4 sentences, and you got it. And I noticed that this writer does the same thing. And so most of the book is action, and the characters, because he does so well in describing them, stand out and become three-dimensional very quickly. So it's an intriguing recommendation from me, Brad.
Put it up for another intriguing. And you're going to log that in a new form for
us. Yes, yes, yes. We saved the best for last. I was, we didn't want to put this right up front because we didn't want people to turn off the show and run and look at it. One of our listeners, Graham Cheater, actually gave us a present for our 50th show, which I did not realize was coming this quickly, but he gave us a present, and it is a chart of all of the books mentioned in the entire show. Not only my recommendations, but the books you discuss in the interviews, as well as every book in our Best of 2019 episode. So we are going to put that up on our website. Graham Cheater runs Judge a Gay Book by Its Cover, which is an online library. The web address is a little long and awkward for me to rattle off, so we will put that in the show notes and also on the listing. And I will be updating that listing from now on, and we'll put up the new chart every week.
We've been asking for somebody to do this for us for quite a while, but never really expecting that somebody that would do all that work for us.
I know.
Thank you, Graham.
It's amazing. It's really amazing.
It was a nice gift.
Yeah. And that's why I've hoped now that we've asked somebody to let us know why book 2 was out before book 1, that maybe somebody out there will know.
So it will be on the Gay Mystery Podcast website, and I don't know where the button will probably be on the top to where you can find it.
Okay.
Figure out where to put it.
It sounds wonderful.
Do you have anything from Weird Tales?
We're excited about the success of Simple Justice, which has a foreword by Chris Rice. And next week we are releasing Time to Check Out by Grant Michaels. It's his 5th book in the Stan Krajicek series. And at the beginning of the book, Stan has inherited $3.5 million and been awarded insurance settlement for another million. And so he is newly wealthy, but newly widowed. And it's a change in tone.
Well, that sounds great.
So who you're interviewing next now?
Garrick Jones is back. He has a new book coming out. So we are going to discuss that amongst other things. And I am very glad to have you back this week. I missed you last week.
Yeah, I kind of missed doing it last week. We hadn't talked in a couple of weeks now.
It's been ages.
It has been ages. I'm looking forward to hearing that nice Australian accent that Garrick has.
Yeah, it makes you swoon.
Yeah, yep.
All right, I'll see you next week.
See you next week.
We're sponsored by Requeered Tales, preserving our LGBTQ literary heritage one book at a time. Check them out at requeeredtales.com. After a 30-year career as a professional opera singer, performing as a soloist in opera houses and in concert halls all over the world, Garrick Jones took up a position as lecturer in music in Australia in 1999 at the Central Queensland Conservatorium of Music, which is now part of CQ University. Brought up in Australia between the bush and the beaches of the eastern suburbs, he retired in 2015 and now lives in the tropics, writing, gardening, and finally finding time to enjoy life and to reestablish a connection with who he is after a very busy career on the stage and as an academic. I want to welcome you back, my good friend Garrick.
G'day there, Brad. Nice to be back again.
Congratulations on your latest release, Wheelchair.
Thank you.
When this airs, it will have released just a few days ago.
Yes, it's due out on the 18th in the US.
I think that's about 3 days before this airs.
Yep.
So it's out there, folks. Buy it.
Yes, actually, the hard copy is out already. It was supposed to be released on the 18th, but for some reason, I think Amazon has it live already, and a lot of the bookshops has been stocking it already too. So that was a nice surprise.
Yeah, that's unusual. Usually they get the Kindle version out and you have to wait for the paperback.
Yeah, I have an arrangement with the Sydney's leading gay bookshop, the bookshop in Darlinghurst. It's called Darlinghurst Bookshop. Get that the wrong way around. And they stocked all my books, and they wrote to me the other day and said that they had copies already and started selling them. So that was a very big surprise.
Yeah, I saw the display on Facebook that they set up for you at the bookstore.
They've been very, very generous. Very generous indeed. And it's great that they're supporting Australian writers. There's not a huge number of us. From memory, I can only think about three or four gay writers. Jeffrey Knight writes some mysteries, I think. He's a friend of yours too. He lives, he's a neighbour, only 300 miles away.
Which is a neighbour in Australia.
Yeah, yeah. May as well be next door.
Well, we're definitely going to talk about Wheelchair, but let's go over a few other things first.
Sure.
You and I have discussed this before. You released 5 novels so far. 3 of them are mysteries or thrillers, and the other 2 are romance novels or anthologies.
They're not really romance, I wouldn't say.
What would you define them as?
It's a gay history, basically, The House with 1,000 Stairs. I mean, there are relationships that run through my books, but that's not the focus. So you could never really say there are romances. They're not generally predictable, you know, boy meets boy, trouble arises, they get together at the end. It doesn't really work like that. It's just about normal people who just happen to be gay, really, and that's the basis of the story. The story's the focus. It's not really the relationship the focus. So that's the reason I'd never describe them as romances.
Excellent clarification. Thank you.
That's my pleasure.
Do you choose not to stick with one genre, or do you write as the spirit moves you?
Well, I really like the mystery genre, but I also like sort of action adventure writing, and I also like to write about relationships and about people. So often the story comes from many different areas, so I just have to write what's there in my mind. So The House with 1,000 Stairs, for example, which was my last release, is actually about the Indigenous Australian culture and how white people interacted with that, and also about the way that they relate to both the land, what they call the country, and other people. And I wanted to write about their culture through the eyes of a white man, and, of course, there's a relationship in it as well. And the other one, which is the anthology of short stories, I wanted to write a sort of potted history about the gay people, gay men from the First World War right through to the Vietnam War. So I wrote 6 short stories, each a decade apart, describing different things that happened in each of those decades and about gay men, not necessarily about relationships, but about how they existed, how they lived, and what happened to them.
And I really enjoyed that book.
Oh, thank you. It's done very, very well, that book. It was surprising when I thought this was my first book ever published, and I thought I'll sell three copies.
Well, the other book of yours I've read is The Cricketer's Arms, and that is the first in your Clyde Smith mysteries.
Yep, the second one's in the works at the moment as we speak. I'm on the just getting to the line edits now. It's been through the developmental edit, and it's going through line edits. That'll come back to me at the end of this week. And then it goes off back to the editor in London at the end of the week after for the proofreading. So that'll be ready to come out in February 2021. And that's called The Gilded Madonna. And it picks up almost immediately after the end of The Cricketer's Arms. Same cast, same crew, same station, be tuned.
Well, so we have the first Cricketer's Arms, and you said you have the second one coming down the pike very soon.
Yep.
Can we expect more from Clyde Smith for the road?
Yes, I've actually got notes on the third book, which is going to be called The Killing at Candle Creek. And that I haven't started writing that. I've got the notes ready done for it. I've done all the research for it. But there's another three books in the line before it get to that. So that'll probably be out mid-year next year, about this time next year.
Now, are you attracted to series novels, or do you find them constraining?
I've written – I have two series on the boil. One is my World War II series, the 7th of December, and I've – for those who haven't listened to my interview with you before, I started writing when I retired, and I wrote a whole lot of books before I thought I had no idea if they were any good or not. And I sent one off to Alexander Voronoff, the gay writer, and he wrote back. He said, "This is terrific. You need to have this professionally proofread and send it to an editor." And I had no idea if it was going to work or not. And Manifold Press in UK just jumped on it. And that's when I decided, I thought, well, maybe I can do this this business of writing, and I got stuck into it. So there's a whole lot of backlog of books that were written, so that I'm not sort of like churning out a new one every month. they all take about 6 months to a year to write, but there are other things I start writing over the top of them during the process.
And
go ahead. The 7th of December is the first one. The sequel to that is called X for Extortion, and that's in edits at the moment. 7th of December, the Manifold, sadly, is closing down. So I'm reissuing that in paperback and in a second edition, which will come out, guess when? 7th of December this year. And then the X for Extortion, which is the sequel, which come out in, I need to check the contract, I think it's April next year. So there'll be three books or maybe four next year, but only three this year, only three. dear.
And the funny thing is, you've told me before that you're not a fast writer.
No, it takes me a long time.
You've published five books in 2 years. It sounds like that you've been working on these quite a while, and they're just, am I correct?
Yeah, totally correct. When I was working at university, my entire life of reading was reading research books. And when I retired, the first couple of weeks I retired, I started looking around for books about characters that I had identified with. There's so much straight literature out there. I wanted to read some gay stuff. And as I was reading, I thought, why is there no Australian gay literature? I couldn't find anything written about my country. And that's something that I'm pretty passionate about, because although, you know, society is pretty homogenous these days, there's a huge difference between cultures, as you know, you look at the culture in LA and the culture in New York, they're so totally different. But between nationalities, the culture in Australia is so unique. We were isolated for the first couple of hundred years of our existence. It took 12 weeks to sail here from Britain. So we developed our own way of behaving and speaking, and I couldn't read anything about gay people. And I thought, well, I'm going to write a story about a gay person based in Australia and about their life And that's what I've continued to do, to really to try and foster my own culture as I've been writing. And they do take a long time. This latest one, Wheelchair, took me 2 years off and on because it was a real struggle for personal reasons to write because of the content. But most books take me about 3 months for the first draft and then another couple of months each for each of the rewrites. So I'd say they're probably about 6 months of writing, sometimes longer, for each story.
You write about Australians and yep. Australian culture, but you have a following in the United States. Do you find yeah. yourself writing with that in mind?
No, I write, you can't write for anybody else. Brad, you're a writer. I know you're writing really well and I love it. You write about your society, where you live, and about your people. That's all I can do. And you wouldn't be thinking about writing for Australians or British people when you're writing Mitch O'Reilly stories, would you?
No, I don't think Mitch would like Vegemite.
Yeah. Well, look, I had the fortune to attend high school in the US and in Canada, and I worked in Boston for 3 years, and I performed all over the US. So the culture's not foreign to me, but I don't feel confident enough that I could write an American protagonist, a main character, for example, because I would be interpreting it from my point of view. So I tend to write about Australians. There's also a big following in the UK too. I think Australia's a bit of a flavour of the month. I'm lucky to be on that bandwagon to have followers, but I get a lot of emails from American readers. And I'm very, very happy for that.
Well, and I totally get where you're coming from. I grew up in two places, but North Carolina is where I lived the longest until I became an adult. And so I still call North Carolina home. And I've thought about writing some novels in North Carolina. You know, I generally write about Los Angeles. And I thought about writing about back home. Well, I've looked at maps. I talked to people. It's a whole different world than when I was there. So it would be almost as difficult for me to write about that area as is Australia. So you really do have to know what you're talking about.
Yeah, and I tend to Wheelchair is my first contemporary novel. I tend to write historical novels because I'm really fascinated with the whole effects of the 1950s. I tend to write about the 1950s, 40s and 50s, mainly because that's the era I grew up in. And we have this really false impression of what life was like. We look at TV and we look at I Love Lucy and all of those sort of television series set in the 1950s. And we see this sort of spanking new world with Formica and everything new and modern, everything old thrown away. But it really wasn't like that. That was a bit of a cover-up to try and recover from the total terrible effects of the Second World War. When I think about that period of the 1950s as growing up surrounded by men who were struggling with what had happened to them in the previous decade and how we didn't let them really speak, like we do now with people, there's so many support groups for veterans from Afghanistan and the war in the Middle East. But the Second World War, which was just horrendous, no one was allowed to talk about it. They came in, they were told to forget about it and move on. And yet these men went through life trying to, you know, cope with this terrible trauma and leave these supposedly normal lives. So that duality has always fascinated me. So that, for example, Clyde Smith, who's a war veteran, I write about him suffering from that and the way that he tries to cope with it and be a normal, nice guy, yet haunted by these terrible memories of being a prisoner of war. That's my fascination.
I was going to ask you about that. The Wheelchair is your first contemporary novel.
Yep.
Why did you make the decision to go with a contemporary novel this time around?
It was a challenge for me. And because there's so much of my own personal life in it, I wanted to not put it in the past where it would be more painful, but to write about it in a contemporary sense. And in fact, I don't think it would have worked set in the 1950s. The whole idea came from, I'm not sure if you're aware of Christine Wright, who's a gay writer in the US, and we're in one of those Facebook pages that no longer exist, and we're talking about points of view. and the conversation came up about multiple points of view, and they said, oh, but the only thing you could never do is write, mix first-person point of view with third-person point of view. And I thought, well, there's a challenge. What possible scenario could you come up with where you could write a book in mixed point of view with first-person point of view and then third-person point of view? So basically, Wheelchair is about a man who suffers badly from OCD and PTSD. And I thought, wouldn't it be interesting to write the first-person points of view with his outlook, what's actually going through his mind, the way he sees his life, and then the alternate points of view about the way that people surround him, his relationships, perceive what he's going through, and how different that actually is to what he's feeling. So that was the premise behind Wheelchair. So it's split into chapters that alternate between the first person point of view, the main character, Simon, and then his relationships around that written from third person point of view.
I love it when somebody says, you can't do this or you can't do that, or you must do this or you must do that. So many prove them wrong, and you obviously have.
Yeah, well, look, my editor, when she wrote back, she said, I could not put this down. And for her to say that, that was pretty amazing, because normally she's very, very professional and very, very tough on me. So I hope it goes well. I mean, it'll either succeed or everybody will hate it. I don't know. I never know with books. I'm sure you're the same.
Yes, I definitely am.
And what you can do is write what comes from inside. If you start writing to a formula, if you do a course on writing and you follow the course details, if you follow rules and things, you'll end up with a book that reads like 50 million others. I think that you've got to write what comes from inside. That's my feeling anyway.
I agree with you. So it's time for awkward questions authors get.
Oh, God.
We'll see if you get a tough one or a rude one, or we'll see whatever you get. So hang tight. I'm going to spin the wheel. Okay, yours isn't a rude one, I can tell you that. But it's one of those that we get quite a bit, and it's tough to answer.
Right.
Where do you get your ideas?
I have, if you read The Quick as Arms, you'll see that Clyde loves to think in the shower, and he has a little stool next to the bath because it's one of these old 1950s affairs where he lays in the bath and the shower is like a hot water heater at the end of the bath, and the shower comes down over his feet. And he has a little stool next to the bath with a notepad on it in which he writes his thoughts when he's trying to work through cases. I have little notebooks everywhere in my house with a pencil next to them. I'm watching TV. The whole idea of the Clyde Smith mystery came to me from watching Endeavour, the story, the British BBC drama, which the first episode was so full of plot holes. I thought, I can do better than this. And I started to think about ideas about Australian detective story. When would I set it? I know, I set it in the 1950s. What makes Australia so different than the rest of the world, except for Britain and India and Pakistan and Sri Lanka and the West Indies? Cricket! So I was writing a story about cricket and an Australian detective. So I started jotting down ideas in notebooks, which then I pulled all together and I went through them all. I started to make a story idea. The ideas come from all over places. Wheelchair came to me from the idea basically that disability doesn't necessarily have to be physical. So in this story, it's a contrast between a man with an emotional disability and a man with a physical disability and the friendship they form. So that's a contrast between those two men struggling with different aspects of their lives.
And I hope you don't mind me saying so, but yeah, when I read the blurb and looked at the cover, I thought of the 70s TV series Ironside.
I don't know that.
I can't think of his name that played Perry Mason.
Raymond Burr?
Raymond Burr played Ironside, and he was in a wheelchair the entire series.
Let me just explain something. Socially disadvantaged to anything that really basically happened between 1973 and 1999, because I was running around the world being an opera singer. I didn't have time to watch TV or catch up on series or see movies. The movie, have you seen it, Beaches, with Bette Midler?
Yes, I have.
The first time I saw that was on cable TV when I was living in Germany. It was dubbed. I had no idea it was a comedy until I saw it on a plane flying across between London and Boston, and it was on the plane, and I roared my head off, and I thought, well, you know, the Germans didn't understand it. So I have no idea what happened on TV in the 70s, 80s and 90s or on the pop music, anything. I lived in a vacuum of classical music. It's all encompassing.
Well, I actually have that challenge now. I watch very little television. The music I listen to tends to be older. So if I write a contemporary novel, which I do, I have to research to find out what is everybody doing right now.
Well, you know very well, I'm always on your case writing to you saying, what does this mean with contemporary stuff? Hey, by the way, can I just tell you, I picked up the Ronil Habard link in your story that you didn't mention the author's name or the book, but I got it.
Oh, good. I figured most anybody that knows L. Ron Hubbard and the story behind that would get the book.
Yeah, a great science fiction reader I was.
Yeah, so for those that don't know, I do a very hint of a book, and most people will pick it up. So you've touched on it, but let's go a little deeper. What is it that makes Aussies unique from the rest of the world?
Well, Australia started off quite differently. When we look at the traditional, the formation of the United States, for example, we think about the Mayflower. It was 1620, and it was a whole religious exodus to form a new colony in the United States. That's the way that we perceive it, whereas Australia was settled as a penal colony. So up until 1857, that's fairly recently, that's in the middle of the Civil War or at the end of the U.S. Civil War. I can remember, 1861, isn't it, the U.S. Civil War? I can never remember. We were getting convicted felons from the UK being sent here in their thousands. So Australia was formed as a penal colony. So how whole sense of not respecting people in positions of power, of being larrikins, you understand that word? That's sort of like miscreants, has formed part of our culture. So and then we were isolated. It took so long for the people to get here. By the time that fast travel came, which was probably in the 1920s with steamerships, big steamerships, it took months to get here. So we were very isolated. And I think the first telegraph didn't come through until the 1860s or 1870s. Yeah, so we're basically an isolated society. So we were basically an isolated society, and it's a rural society, and Australia's a really tough place. You know, you think about the Midwest in America, that big cornfield area, we didn't have any of that. The whole interior of Australia, apart from the coastal areas, is pretty well scrubland and desert. There's some farming area for 400 or 500, 600 kilometres from the coast inland, but most of it is uninhabitable and because lack of water. We think of the Mojave Desert basically for millions and millions and millions of square miles.
Back to wheelchair.
Yep.
Your blurb for that novel says it's a slow burn psychological crime thriller.
Yep.
What do you mean by slow burn?
The slow burn is, slow burn's been rather hijacked by the romance community to mean a smouldering relationship. But if you look at the origin of slow burn, the term comes from when people had long either trails of gunpowder that were slightly dampened so that they burned slower, or they had slow burn fuses leading to an explosion, so that the story starts off and it builds up very, very slowly until we get a big explosion towards the end where the denouement, the revelation of what's actually happened during the story happens. So it's not action-packed all the way through. It builds slowly with twists and turns during the story.
Most Hitchcock films are that way.
Yeah, I didn't plot it like that, but it turned out like that because I thought there needs to be – the story is basically about this guy, Simon Dyson, who's been a street kid, made good, and he ends up being a history lecturer at a university, and how he's unwittingly caught up in a cross-border crime war as a drug mule. He doesn't realise it, but the car he's driving has drugs in the boot, and he becomes in a comes involved in a serious motor accident when the criminals are trying to get the drugs back. That's the premise of the story. So the whole story revolves around this drug ring and how he's unwittingly caught up with it, and his friends are caught up with it, and there's undercover cops and there's federal police, and yeah, it's I think it's a really interesting story, but it's interwoven. That interweaving goes on around the inner mind of this man who's, you know, severely mentally disabled, and the policeman who comes to his aid, who's also seriously injured, who ends up in a wheelchair, hence the name of the story. So that's, we have the two guys, one in a wheelchair and one with a struggling with his mind, and how they form a friendship around this big drug crime.
Well, I'm curious because the full title of the book is Wheelchair, Antarctica, Ice and Snow.
Ah. You have to read it. I'm not going to give that away.
Okay. how unfair.
Yeah,
actually, no, that's being fair. Nobody wants to know.
Yeah. Well, my publisher, when I said to her, she said, that is so clever. So, yeah, I don't want to give that away. I think that's one of those I'm a bit sort of reluctant when I write. My editor often sends me back. She says, where is this scene happening? And I write little margin notes saying, read on a few paragraphs. You know, I don't believe in spoon-feeding the reader. I think that's a different sort of genre of writing. You've read a couple of my books. I'm a bit of a dense writer, and I like to sort of tease the reader out a bit so that they're led to their own conclusions, that they find out where things are coming. That's part of mystery, isn't it?
I would
agree. You don't want
to
reveal everything. You don't want to pull up the curtain and go, here you are, guys, here's the answer here right in front of you. You've got to tease it out a bit.
Writing such different novel, do you find, or what would you say is your voice? Like, how do I know I'm reading a book by Garrick Jones?
Well, if you ask my mate Dan Studer, he'd say all the guys have hairy chests. He said to me, have you got a fixation with hairy chests? He wrote to me, yeah, well, maybe. no, what is my voice? I think it's probably the Australian. I did a poll, I think, that you saw it, about whether you should use local language and acronyms when you're writing a story or explain them out for readers from other countries. Well, I tell you, Brad, when I'm reading American novels, like when I've been reading your book, I have to look things up. That goes with the territory. I think that my voice is writing as an Australian from an Australian perspective. And that's different. I mean, it's close enough, I think, to be interesting. When I read stuff that's I read something fairly recently which was set in Louisiana, and it was written from as a Creole man's point of view, and I found that was really fascinating. I didn't understand every word, but it was the flavor and the use of language and the description that I really got into, and that's the way that I write. And if you want to read pulp novels, then don't go looking for my books, because that's not the way I write.
Well, you remind me of the day I mentioned a toaster oven, and you quickly Googled
that?
It, and you're like, I have never seen that thing before.
No, exactly. Well, for example, if I said to you that when I was a kid, our favorite food were Jaffles, you would go, what
the hell are you talking about?
Yeah. I don't know. They look like a brassiere. They're like two round metal discs hinged at the middle with handles, and you put bread inside, buttered bread inside on each one of those cups, if you like, and you put filling in it and you close it up, so it's and put it on the gas flame or on the wood stove, and you cook your toasted sandwich. That was what we used to call them, Jaffles. So if I was writing a 1950s book, I wouldn't say a toasted sandwich, I'd say a Jaffle, and I'd expect people to look that up because that's the way people spoke at the time. You can't put anachronisms when you're writing historical fiction. I had to do so much research when I was writing Wheelchair to find about how younger people talk and how they behave with each other, because I have no idea anymore. I'm 72. I don't go to clubs and pubs and don't hang out with footy boys anymore. I'd like to, but I don't.
And Wheelchair is a contemporary novel. So what type of research did that require?
Oh, boy, oh, boy. Basically, the story revolves around is Simon Dyson with PTSD. His is caused by childhood abuse. And there's often a feeling of the victim feeling like they're responsible for their abuse, especially when it's childhood abuse. They feel that they're a bad person, and they go through life trying to find things that will take away that guilt. They often actually play out the scenarios of the physical abuse when they were children as adults. That's where we get the BDSM sadomasochistic scene and everything. But I discovered this whole world of gay boxing and gay wrestling. Did you know such a thing existed?
I am aware of gay wrestling. I lived in the Valley here in LA, and there was a complex not far from me that had gay wrestling, but I have never attended.
Well, there's a whole scene of guys who fantasize about gay boxing who, you know, take the boxing part seriously, but they really like to be thrashed in the ring. And then after they're thrashed in the ring, they like to, you know, plant their face on the canvas and let the other guys have a go, which was just beyond my total experience. And I thought to myself, this is just such an interesting area of human sexuality. And that's when I discovered humiliation play. And I joined a whole lot of online forums to discover this whole aspect of very macho sports in which one person decides to either be the winner or the loser before a match starts. So they work it out, they have safe words and stuff like that. So the same as S&M, but it's all about physical beating up and getting their jollies out of that and having sex afterwards. And it's huge. I had no idea. So what I did was I put out, I invented an anonymous email address. I put out on all of the forums if people were interested in talking anonymously, and I interviewed 28 guys. There were all sorts. There were ex-cops, there were council workers, there was a guy who was a judge. And some of them, we actually were brave enough to do online chats, but most of the time it was by email. And I discovered this whole world. And that's the research not only shook me, but I think it makes fascinating reading in the book how people live with such a thing. It's not their only sexual expression or only emotional expression, but it forms such a part of them. Like if you have OCD, you know, most people think of OCD as, you know, washing your hands frequently, making sure you close the door, turning the gas off. And there's an itch that goes with that that has to be scratched, otherwise you can't continue to function. Well, these guys have that itch every so often to be humiliated or to humiliate someone else, otherwise they can't continue to exist as human beings. And that's the basis of the story.
And that's fascinating. That would fill a lot of psychological books.
And also there's a lot of therapeutic sessions throughout the book where the two characters are talking with their respective therapists about how you deal with that, about acceptance. And I thought that also might, as a person who's been in therapy most of my life, I thought it'd be very interesting to talk about what therapy is really like rather than the idea of guy lying on the couch with a psychiatrist going, tell me about your mother. And as anybody who's been through therapy would tell you, it's not actually about that. It's about you learning to accept what's not been good, what hasn't gone well, and that change comes through acceptance, not through any a third person's intervention in your mind. Would you agree with that?
I would agree with that. We're always on the same wavelength.
Yeah.
So back, the name of the novel is Wheelchair.
Yep.
And it's currently available. Would the best way to find the different locations be going to your website or?
Yeah, going to my website or it's on Amazon, Smashwords. I think it's already Barnes & Noble. I haven't checked this morning, but they usually pick up pretty soon. Target will have it. That's an amazing thing. I mean, the gay world comes to Middle America, Middle Australia, that my books are available in Target. That's mind-boggling.
Yeah, I was surprised. It's not on the shelves at Walmart, but my book is available through Walmart.
Oh, that's good.
Yeah.
Well, we should be. I mean, our voices are part of the, you know, general community now. It's only really weird people who think gay people are not part of the rest of the world.
So it's available pretty much everywhere. Thank you very much for your time.
It's been wonderful as ever.
Hit the subscribe button wherever you hear our show so you don't miss a single episode. tell a friend too. Thank you for listening.